Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Veterans Radio Podcast. Cyrus Raymond here from the Legal Help for Veterans Studio in Northville, Michigan. Just want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. And also would like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Jim Fossone right here on the Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And good afternoon. This is Jim Fossone on Veterans Radio. With me is Dale Thronberry. Dale, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and welcome everybody to Veterans Radio.
We're glad to have everybody on board. This is going to be an interesting show, talking about some drone and cyber missions and all those sorts of things that we see and read a little bit about, so we'll have some real experts to talk about it. We're pleased to bring on the air to you for, I think, the first time, Colonel Ron Wilson from the 110th Attack Wing in Battle Creek, Michigan. Ron has a long and distinguished career with the Michigan Air National Guard. Let me just go over a little bit of his career bio for you. We won't give him too much grief about this, but Colonel Wilson is a 1982 graduate of the University of Wisconsin. What do you think about that?
I saw you
had your eyebrows raised. So,
right. It's still within the same conference. So that's
there. You go. He's still Big Ten. So he received his commission from the ROTC program, and he served 8 years active duty and more than now 22 years in the Air National Guard. He's been at Battle Creek for almost all of that time and has had a variety of assignments throughout the country. From pilot training to being the aircraft commander at all sorts of different assignments throughout the country. So, Colonel Wilson, I think you're on board with us, and we want to welcome you to the Veteran Radio audience.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Sorry, we had a little technical trouble getting through, but we're on now, so I'm happy to be on the show with you.
Well, we're grateful for you to take a little time on Sunday to talk to our audience. We have folks not only listening to us on WAAM 1600 Talk Radio, but on veteransradio.net. Our internet application lets people all around the country listen to you. We have folks out in Guam, I think, who...
We do have people all over the world, actually. We have some devoted and dedicated listeners down in Australia, so they're very interested in what's going on all the time.
So we're happy to have you, Colonel. Let's start with a little bit of how did you get involved, interested in your military career, and what sort of set you off into this direction?
Sure, you bet. I grew up in Wisconsin, and I always wanted to fly since as old as I can remember, probably 4 or 5 years old. Upon graduating high school, I graduated from Elkhart Lake High School in Wisconsin. I then went up to Superior, Wisconsin, and entered the University of Wisconsin, the Superior Extension up there, and they have an ROTC program, an Air Force ROTC program. So I joined that. And competed very well, and ended up getting a pilot training slot out of college, and was commissioned a Air Force officer. I then proceeded down to Lubbock, Texas, Reese Air Force Base, and I did my year of undergraduate pilot training down at Reese Air Force Base. Again, competing for top spots, and I did well at that. So I got my first selection out of there, which was the A-10 Warthog. And went off to fighter leading school in Alamogordo, New Mexico at Holloman Air Force Base, and then on to Tucson, Arizona, Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, which was where you learned how to fly the A-10. Upon graduation there, I headed off for England Air Force Base in Louisiana, Alexandria, Louisiana, and I flew active duty there for 3.5 years flying the A-10. And then once I was done with that, my next assignment was back to Holloman Air Force Base as a fighter lead-in instructor. Upon completion of that assignment, I then decided to get out of the Air Force, and I got on with American Airlines, flying for them, and have flown for them ever since. But I'd missed the military, so I looked into the Air National Guard and looked at a bunch of bases, and Battle Creek, Michigan was getting A-10s, so that's where I ended up. And I got to fly A-10s here at Battle Creek for 17 years. And then we lost the A-10 through the BRAC, which is the base realignment closure, in 2005. And the airplanes actually left in 2008. And then we went through about 6 years of, what mission are we going to fly? We flew C-21s for a little while, for about 4 years. That was a Learjet, that took VIPs and DVs around the country, military. And for a while we're going to fly something called a C-27. It's a C-130 light cargo aircraft. That got canceled by the president. So at that point, we were awarded the MQ-9, RPA, which RPA stands for remotely piloted aircraft. And, we are in the process right now of standing that up. And as I worked my way through, the Battle Creek ranks, I ended up as a squadron commander, back in the A-10 days. And then, I ended up as an ops group commander, which is command of the operations side of the house, and closed out the A-10, flying, and did that flying C-21s and started into the RPA. And then I became the vice wing commander and eventually the wing commander. I've been the wing commander now for almost 3 years. And like I said, we are in the midst of standing up the RPA mission. We have currently 15 pilots trained, 13 sensor operators, and right now, because we do not have a building yet, we're working on that. Our pilots are flying all over the country at other units. So that kind of brings me up to speed on where we are today.
So let me back you up, and if we have a little time at the end, we may back up to talk about the A-10s. We've had your predecessor, retired Colonel Roger Seidel, on to talk about the DOD's plan on the A-10s, and
sure.
Been in the news a little bit, so if we have time, I'll get to that. But we're really bumped into you, month or more ago at the Battle Creek base, and you were mentioning the remotely piloted aircraft or RPA mission, and I said, boy, we've got to talk about that. So that kind of is the focus of today's program, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about what does not in military speak, but in plain English, what does remotely piloted aircraft mean? What's the RPA program?
Sure. It is, I think a lot of the public, hears the word drone, and to the military, that's kind of a bad word, I guess, because it's got such a bad connotation in the press. But we like to call it the remotely piloted aircraft, and that is what Battle Creek has or is getting is something called remote split ops. And if you think about it in layman's terms, what that means is the cockpit of the airplane is sitting here at Battle Creek. And controlled by Battle Creek Airmen. The aircraft themselves are actually flying overseas, and in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and all the places that are needed. The aircraft is about the size of an A-10. What that means to people, I guess, the wingspan is about 66 feet wide. So it is a fairly good-sized aircraft. The aircraft does ISR. So what it has is a sensor ball on it.
And ISR stands for?
Stands for Intelligence, Survey, and Reconnaissance. That's one of its missions. Another mission is it is a strike aircraft, so it does drop bombs from the aircraft. And the aircraft, the good thing about the RPA is it can stay airborne for a very long time. We're talking 12, 14, 16 hours. So it's airborne for a long time, so it can do that surveillance stuff on enemy positions overseas. So it's controlled by us at Battle Creek. We have a separate unit, if you will, over wherever the aircraft is based overseas, and they are called a launch and recovery element, and they are responsible for getting the aircraft airborne, and then they fly it to a couple thousand feet, and then Battle Creek, or whatever unit happens to be flying it, takes over control via satellite link and a cable underneath the ocean, and we take control of the aircraft. And then we have three people who run it. One is a pilot, and he does what you would think for a normal pilot. One is a sensor operator, and the sensor operator operates the optical ball inside, which is your cameras that look at your targets. And then we have somebody called a MIC, and that's your intelligence guy, and he's gathering intelligence from all kinds of sources to find out what's going on the ground. You know, what kind of threats there are to the aircraft, what kind of threats are to other aircraft that we have flying in the area that may be manned aircraft. So that's kind of it in a nutshell what the RPA does. It basically does everything we did in the A-10, except the pilot is just not sitting in the aircraft. He is sitting back here on the ground performing the same kind of functions.
So, Colonel, let's talk a little bit about the training that you've mentioned, and let's focus on the unit that's with the the 110 airlift wing. You mentioned you have 15 pilots and 13 sensor operators. Let's talk a little bit about the training that the pilots go through first. How does that differ from what we might be thinking of pilot training, and give us some of that insight?
Yeah. This is all new technology stuff. So, as we're spinning up into this thing, the guys that we had here before, the A-10 guys, some other kinds of backgrounds, went through your basic pilot training, 1 year of pilot training, then went off and flew some kind of aircraft, be it A-10s, F-16s. We have some that flew tankers or cargo type aircraft. And then we hire them here at Battle Creek, and they're fully qualified pilots, and then we send them off to RPA school, if you will. And ours, the one that we go to mostly, is in Syracuse, New York, and that is another guard unit that has something called it's called an FTU, and it stands basically for the training unit. They train all the pilots, and they go through about 5 months of getting used to flying an RPA. A little bit different because it's a little bit more computer-based. The other thing is when you're flying overseas, when you turn, say you're going to make a right turn, when you put the input in, nothing happens for about 2 seconds, and then the aircraft will start to turn. So that's something the pilots have to get used to. It's a little bit abnormal from what they're used to. And they go through 5 months of that, and when they come out of that, they have basic qualification. So they can fly the airplane, they can climb the L2, they can turn, and they can operate all the systems. Then they have to go through something called mission-ready training. And that's another month and a half, depending on how well the guy's doing. And then he'll come up to speed on actually employing the airplane. What I mean is working with ground personnel on the radio, working with AWACS aircraft, dropping bombs, finding targets. Now once those guys are mission ready, now they can sit in that seat and they can go into what we call a combat sortie.
So, Colonel, in regular aircraft, you're getting rated for different types of airframes. Is it the same thing with UAVs, or do you get rated for a certain type of, to use the civilian term, drone or unmanned vehicle, or do they all sort of, once you're rated across the board?
No, you're right. It's very similar. The two kinds of variants that they have out, that for the most part, there's a few others, but the two main RPA or UAV aircraft that are out in the Air Force right now, one is the MQ-1 Predator, and the other one is the MQ-9 Reaper. And all our guys are getting trained on the MQ-9 Reaper. It is a different aircraft. The MQ-9 Reaper is more of a bomb-dropping aircraft, whereas it's bigger, And the MQ-1 Predator is more of just that ISR. They look, you know, with cameras and take pictures and try to find out intelligence. And they're different aircraft. They have different characteristics. The MQ-1 Predator is a lot smaller, and the MQ-9 Reaper is a lot bigger aircraft. It flies a lot faster. So they are different, and you're correct. You need to get rated in each one. We are standing up the MQ-9 mission. There are other guard units around the country that have been in the MQ-1, and now they are converting, and they'll all at some point will all be MQ-9 because that's the newer technology. It can do more capabilities. You know, that airplane can do not only ISR, but it also can employ weapons. So that's what the Air Force is looking for.
With just a few minutes left before we hit our news break, with respect to the pilots, at 15 pilots, is that anticipated to be Battle Creek's full complement? And how many, if you're up in the air running for 12 or 16 hour shifts, how many RPA missions can you run with 15 pilots?
Yeah, the 15 is what we are up to so far, but we're still in the process of standing the mission up. When we're all done, we are supposed to go what they call IOC, initial operating experience, happens in August of 2016. And that means we'll have our building all built, the cockpits will be here at Battle Creek, and we'll have our full complement of pilots trained by then, and that is a little bit north of 50 pilots. And that also is 50 sensor operators and 50 of the intel guys. On a 16, 18-hour mission, each pilot will fly about 4 hours. And it varies a little bit when they're trying to find out what the best mix is. But it'll be 4 hours, and it might be 4 hours where you're just sitting up there looking at something. When we're flying overseas, and any time collateral damage is a possibility.
Colonel, this is Dale Thronberry. I was wondering if the pilots are flying in cockpits, are they like trainers or simulators, or how is the setup of the crew when they're working a mission?
You bet. It's called a ground control station, and it is like a cockpit on the ground, basically. We will have at Battle Creek, we'll have two permanent ones, and then there's also one is a mobile control station, which is basically on a semi-trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But the pilot is in there, and the sensor operator is next to the pilot operating that sensor ball. And then the intel guy is kind of in the background. He's working phones and a computer, like a computer chat line with all kinds of agencies. So he's a little bit more in the background, but the cockpit is the two people, the sensor and the pilot.
It sounds fascinating. I was just reading an article during the break from Army General Martin Dempsey that says he will never use the word drone, and you will never hear him use the word unmanned aerial systems, because they're not. They are remotely piloted aircraft, and I guess that's a term that we all have to get used to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the drone kind of, one, it's got the bad connotation, and two, it means something that's not piloted by anybody. These are highly sophisticated aircraft. And it takes about 140 people on the ground to have these operations go correctly. So there's a lot to it.
That's what I was going to say. If you're going to have 50 pilots and 50 of these, you're going to have 500 or so. It's going to become a large contingent out there.
It is. And like I said, it takes a lot. And the other thing you got to remember is this is a 24/7 mission. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do this 24/7, 365 days a year. So at all times you'll have pilots flying them from Battle Creek once we stand up here at Battle Creek.
And, Colonel, can you talk a little bit about the rank of the pilots, the officers who are going to be flying here? Does this integrate right into the normal rank system for those who would otherwise be pilots?
It does. In any squadron of aircraft or anything, you want a little bit of variety. So you've got some younger guys, you know, your lieutenants and your young captains, and then the leadership in the squadron is usually majors and colonels, light colonels, and you have some of them too. So we got a normal complement of rank throughout the squadron.
Well, you told us about the training for the pilots. Can you talk to us a little bit about the sensor operators and the training that they all go through for this new world, new technology?
You bet. And I'm not quite as familiar, obviously, because I'm not a sensor operator, but they go through almost the same amount of training the pilots do, just a hair less. And they can be an enlisted person or they could be an officer, but they're not the rated type. But their main mission is to operate that sensor ball. So they need to keep, you know, if it's the video part, they need to keep that on the target. We have an IR part, an infrared part. They need to keep that, find the targets. And it's a very intense tasking to keep that, because you got to remember that same thing the pilot has, if that two-second delay, the sensor operator has that too. So when he tries to move the target tracking cross or the ball around, he has to lead it by 2 seconds.
And is the communication that then to the intel officer, is he the one who's communicating back maybe with ground forces or other aircraft in the area that may take action relative to the target?
Absolutely. He is communicating with everybody. He's communicating with commanders on the ground for their intent, what they want to do. He's communicating with somebody called a JTAC, and that's usually the person that's closest to the target that has eyes on from the ground. He's communicating with the AWACS aircraft that are airborne, that are telling them where all the other aircraft are. So he's communicating with a lot of people, and then the pilot and the sensor also.
Colonel, how difficult has it been to find, not just for the Battle Creek group, but really for the Air Force or the Air National Guard entirely, to find pilots and sensor operators to move into this new field?
Yeah, it's so far for us, it's been pretty good. We've got guys ready to go to training, but as we move into this mission, I think it is going to be a challenge. It's a whole different ball game. You know, when we were in A-10s, we would train here, prepare for war, deploy to war, and then, you know, fight the war and you'd come home. Now a guy is home with his wife and kids and he leaves and goes and flies combat from Battle Creek with an airplane overseas and does combat for 4 to 8 hours, and then he goes back home. And he does it day in and day out. So the amount of flying, the amount of combat action, you know, probably will tend to wear on people. They're going to see a lot of things that aren't pleasant to see sometimes when you talk in combat. And it's, like I said, it's at 24 hours, you know, on Christmas Eve, somebody will be out here flying one of those aircraft. So it's tougher. It's tougher. Yeah, I think it will be a challenge to recruit to, and it's a new paradigm we're trying to kind of figure out as we go.
One of the things that's always been of concern is that the guard mission, because when you're stationed on a base, you go back and you may stay on the base quarters. There's more community input. It sounds like that you're thinking about how the stresses are different under this mission on the troops, and how to maybe deal with that or combat that, not only in recruitment but also in retention, and how they integrate back into the community at home with their spouses and family and civilian workforce. Is that part of the conversation now at the leadership level?
Absolutely. It is a big part of the conversation. You know, a guard unit is designed to have lots of part-time guys who come in on the weekend and then spin up for war. Since this is a 24/7 mission, we have more full-time force than we had before, and we still have to have our part-timers in on this too, you know, the ones who come in on that drill weekend. So it's a different mix than it used to be, and absolutely the base community is different. Now all our support folks, they're not only supporting people, 8 to 5, but they're also supporting people at 2 in the morning. So it's different. Our chaplains and we have a WDPH, a psychological health professional on base, that this takes on a whole new role for them because of the type of mission.
Well, Colonel, we really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about the RPA mission. There, as you know, because you and I've had some dialogue on it, there is an Air Force memo out, internal service memo out, regarding concern that the fleet that's flying these RPAs is sort of at the breaking point. And we're going to talk about that a little bit with our next guest. I don't want to push you out any farther on the limb than appropriate.
No problem.
but I think you've really educated us a lot, and that's been really helpful. As you stand this mission up and get closer to August of 2016, I'm sure Veterans Radio will want to check back in with you.
We want to go there.
Yeah, and see how this is done. Dale's an old chopper pilot, so he's having a hard time visualizing all this.
I want to go there. I want to see this stuff.
I don't see this. It's a different type of mission.
Well, we really appreciate the time that you've spent with us this afternoon. We'll let you get back to your family, and thank you and the 110th Airlift Wing for all it's doing to protect us here in this country.
You bet. We're glad to serve.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.